Lobbyists.
We have to be out of here by 2:45, so that's the good news.
We are committed.
I like that part.
That's true.
Was it still every day?
I don't know. Do you have the list of bills that we're working on today?
It was my day.
I think we're gonna have to print these kinds of things.
All right.
I have it.
All right.
Right here.
The House Committee on Revenue will come to order. Thank you all for being here on time today. I'm having a bit of difficulty getting my computer up and running, which I assume will happen soon. I'd like to take a minute, even though it's not on the agenda, for us to introduce ourselves, since several of us are new on the committee. And I think I'll just take the prerogative and ask the person on my far left to go first.
Thank you. I'm Representative Barbara Smith Warner from Northeast Portland, Maywood Park and Park Rose, and thrilled and eager to be serving on the Revenue Committee for my first session.
Welcome, Representative.
I'm Mark Johnson from House District 52. I live in Hood River, which needs no explanation. We're happy to be here and serve along with you all.
I'm Representative John Davis from House District 26 in the metropolis of Wilsonville. Come on, 5 o'clock. We got live things
line up here.
We're all in our lunch coma. We
got my favorite rest area on 205.
Representative Cliff Benz, District 60.
Phil Barnhart, House District 11.
Jessica Vega Peterson, House District 47 in East Portland.
I'm Tobias Reed from District 27 in Beaverton.
You don't know how
to. I'm Ann Leininger in House District 38. I live in Lake Oswego and represent Lake Oswego and Southwest Portland.
You can't do it.
I'm Representative Whitsitt, not the one from the other side. Everybody's always confusing us. And House District 56, which is Klamath and Lake Counties.
Bravo. Let's go ahead on to our agenda then, which is adoption of committee rules. Paul, would you introduce the committee rules to us?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the rules are in OLS, so the rules are those provided to us by the House Clerk, so there's nothing out of the ordinary. A couple of things refer to one of the number 7. There's a reference to if the committee doesn't complete its agenda, the items may be carried over to the next scheduled meeting. So just a reminder of that. It just has to remain in the form it's in that you were considering it. For example, you couldn't have a public hearing on a bill and then change it to work session the next day with carrying it over. So it has to stay in its form. There's some other references that I'll refer you to at the end. One is that number 22, no measure can be reported out of committee unless legislative council amendments, fiscal revenue statements have been distributed. We of course have the revenue statements for you and make sure you'll have those, but we also have to work with fiscal, and they of course have a lot of demands, so there are times when we don't have our fiscal statements, so we'll work with them as much as we can to make sure you get those for work sessions. So those are the only 2 points, Mr. Chair. I think the rest the committee members are pretty familiar with.
Right. Okay. Representative Benz?
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the committee rules for the House Revenue Committee 78th Legislative Assembly.
As Representative Benz moves the adoption of the committee rules for the committee as printed. Discussion? Seeing no discussion, is there any objection to the motion? Hearing none, it is so ordered. Introduction of committee bills. Representative Benz?
Chair, I hope I have this language right, but I move introduction of committee bills LC 0335. 2015 regular session, LC 1450, 2015 regular session, LC 2982, 2015 regular session, LC 3166, 2015 regular session, and LC 3353, 2015 regular session.
Thank you. Representative Benz moves LC's for introduction as committee bills, LC 0335, LC 1450, LC 2982, LC 3166 and LC 3353. It should be noted that agreeing to a motion to introduce bills as committee bills is not an indication of an opinion about the bill or an opinion about whether the bill should be heard or adopted, but simply a courtesy to allow a bill to be introduced. And with that, is there any discussion on the motion? Is there any objection to the motion? Hearing none, it is so ordered. And for that, we'll close the work session on adoption of committee rules and introduction of committee bills and open an informational meeting on the overview of basic facts. Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, we have just finished our latest edition, and I know everyone's been anxiously awaiting this, our Oregon Public Finance Basic Facts 2015 volume. And you have that in OLIS, and we will provide copies for anyone like when it's on our website. But we thought what we would do is go through some of the highlights of that with you, just as a give you a general background of kind of some of the basic elements of our public finance system in Oregon, give you an opportunity to ask any questions on anything you'd like to spend a little bit more time on. We do have some of the major pieces of this document we won't go through today because we have it scheduled later. We have a session on school finance scheduled for Thursday, along with transportation funding, which of course are two big elements for this. Mm-hmm. And we also have a tax credit report and a tax expenditure report that we will go through with you tomorrow. So we won't get into things like the tax credits and the income tax code. So I'll start. I've got the overview piece that's the document. And what we do with this overview piece, one thing I should say before we proceed is that we do have for new members, we do have our organization chart in there, so you can see that our economists, and we have some of our economists here today. Maybe I should go ahead and introduce them for our
members.
Oh,
that'd be fantastic. Yes,
we have Chris Allenax, one of our senior economists. Edward Klein is back with us again this session as a committee assistant, so he'll be with you the entire session. Mazen Malik is standing in the corner there. Our newest economist is Kyle Easton, and Kyle will be working on property taxes, tobacco taxes, and estate taxes.
So we saved up a lot of work for you.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
For this session.
Mm-hmm. Christine Broniak is with us again. She's moved to personal income taxes. Chris is focusing primarily on tax credits on the income tax side. Christine will be doing the deductions, the Federal Connect issues, subtractions, a lot of the elements around the personal income tax that you've dealt with. She'll be running our tax calculator that provides revenue estimates for various proposed changes in the structure of the income tax. And then Day Beck is here. Day is does school finance for us, and you'll be hearing from Day on Thursday. And he's also does health provider taxes. He does employment taxes as well for us.
Great. We are very pleased to be back, and I'm sure that we'll give you some very interesting things to work on.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to get in trouble.
Yes.
I didn't see Corinne Gavette in the corner. Corinne is our office manager, and she's the one that makes the trains run on time.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes. And I think those of us who are familiar with the office understand that Corinne actually runs the place.
Yes.
Right. Okay. All right. Thank you. On to basic facts.
Okay, so the basic facts document we put in the latest information from the Census Bureau. The Census conducts an annual survey of state and local finances, and that normally comes out in the summer. But every 5 years, they do a census of governments. And that came out this year, I think, almost Christmas Eve, maybe the 22nd or something, December. So that's a more comprehensive look at the data from the state and local governments, and that's what you see here. It is for the 11-12 fiscal year. So there is, of course, a couple of years lag here, but as we've seen with this data, it's gradually caught up with the recovery. And the 11-12 numbers do reflect an economy that is, while not at full capacity, is at least getting relatively close. And some of the distortions we saw, particularly in the 09-10 data, are getting kind of washed out as we get into this phase of the business cycle. I'll just comment on some of the initial tables there. The first one under table one, as you can see on the overhead, table one shows three main measures of overall revenue. One is called total revenue, which is the sum of all the components. It's important to point out that some of these components are really not available for a provision of public services. They include, you can see the bottom line there, the bottom row is insurance trust revenue. That's basically public employee retirement funds. It's also unemployment compensation funds. So it's funds that you don't really have at your disposal to allocate. Of course, the public employee retirement funds are primarily determined in Oregon by the performance of the financial markets. So these will bounce way up and down. It just happens we're in the middle of the state. You can see 25th on the insurance trust revenue. But we've been everywhere from bottom 10 to top 10, depending on how the market does. And we are more sensitive because we are more dependent on market conditions for that fund.
Is that a per capita analysis?
Yes, it's a per person, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, so $743 per person.
But the rank is also based on the same.
Yes, the rank's based on the, yes.
Okay.
So, and we have it by as a percentage of personal income in some of the other tables. You can see in terms of taxes, these are all taxes, state and local government. We collect $3,789 per person in Oregon in 11-12. So keep in mind this has local as well as state. Federal revenue, you can see an area where we have traditionally been above average is in our use of charges, where we are a little over $1,600 per person. The biggest charge in this component for all the states is tuition and higher ed. So you don't think of that as a charge, but that is the most. The second largest is healthcare related, usually for public services. The South, for example, there's a lot of publicly run hospitals, and so that's the second largest component. Those two together account for about 2/3 of that number. Miscellaneous, by the way, does include lottery revenue. And we'll talk some about that later, but that's embedded in that category. If you look at table two, you can see a more narrow breakdown for taxes. The average per person taxes is $3,789.
Just a moment. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul, the table one is, that's just a year, right?
Table one is for the 11-12 fiscal year. So it's the census data for the 11-12 fiscal year.
So those of us are looking at the total revenue and seeing it's just $9 billion, would take that times two to get to a biennium number. So would we do or not?
Representative Vince, the $9,599 is per person. So you have to multiply that by about $4 million and then multiply it by two.
Thank you. So that's per person times two and then times $4 million. Thank you.
Let me get you there. Mm-hmm. The census data comes out in the raw categories when we download it for spending in all these areas. We input personal income and population for all the states, so that's why we can generate these rankings. And we do have, by the way, if there's ever any interest in it, we do have detailed categories for expenditures as well from the census. Table two, again, shows you the tax structure. And by the way, the average number per person for the country for state and local governments is about $4,500. So you can see we rank 29th. We're about $700 below the average for the country on taxes. Personal income tax, you can see we rank relatively high among the states. And corporate and property taxes right in the middle as we've traditionally been, or we've been in recent years. And general sales tax, of course, we're tied with the other four states that don't have a general retail sales tax. The category where we have seen a lot of movement upward is selective sales taxes, because that includes health provider taxes. And we've instituted those gross receipts-based taxes on health providers, and that's move that number up a bit compared to where it's been in recent years. The other components of that category is tobacco taxes. Some states, of course, will tax alcoholic beverages with an excise tax rather than a government enterprise, as we do here. So that gives you a sense of our overall tax breakdown. If you look on pages three and or tables three and four, they take those exact same categories and convert them into personal income. The personal income is from the Bureau of Economic Analysis. They calculate it for every state, and what it's adjusted for residents, so that we have some that pay taxes in Oregon that live in Clark County, work in Oregon, they pay taxes. They're not included in that per capita piece or that personal income data. So that can be a little misleading. On the taxes, you can see the percent of income. Oregon's total taxes take about 10% of personal income. The average nationally is about 10.5%. So we rank pretty much in the middle, 27th. We rank a little bit higher on a percent of income than we do on a per capita basis because our per capita income is lower than the national average. You can see that, and that's true of most of the categories as a percent of income. One thing I would say, just in kind of to keep in mind about some of this data, particularly when you start looking at other states, an important factor is that these are just state and local taxes that are imposed in that state. That doesn't mean in an economic sense that it's the citizens of that state that pay those taxes. And that's why you can get some distortions. Like the number one state, for example, in terms of tax burden is Alaska. Mm-hmm. Well, Alaska has no income tax. It has no general sales tax. How can it be number one? Well, one thing, you don't have many people. Yeah. And number two, they have very high severance taxes on oil and gas. Of course, in an economic sense, is it really Alaskan residents that are paying that? Probably not. It's embedded in the price of the consumers, including us in Oregon.
It is the best oil and gas. It's the best possible tax.
Yes, that's right.
The one that someone else pays.
Exactly, yes. It's called tax exporting.
Right.
So, yeah, same thing is true in Nevada with their gross gaming receipts tax. So, if you look on the table on page 5, you can see how over time our major taxes have changed. We go back to 82-83. A quick sense tells you that the history of the tax system and the fundamental restructuring that occurred with the property tax initiatives. If you go back to 89-90, for example, just prior to Measure 5, you can see that property taxes, we ranked 5th in the country as a percent of income and 7th on a per capita basis. So in a very broad aggregate sense, the effect of the property tax initiatives was to move Oregon from a high property tax state relatively to an average property tax state. So that gives you that chart, I think, shows you historically what happened. You can see the phase in of Measure 5, the 5-year phase in that ended in 95-96, followed by Measure 50 that basically constrained growth since that time. We did actually gain a little bit of ground relative to other states during the housing bust because property taxes were more sensitive to market values in most states than they were in Oregon because of Measure 50. The next chart I'll refer you to is on A7, table A7, which Mazin puts this together. This is a summary of all the taxes that we have in Oregon. So it's a good reference chart for you when somebody raises some obscure tax and you wonder, do we actually impose that? And this tells you what it is and the dollars that we raise on an annual basis. It also, we try to show that 10-year look of how it's changed over that period of time. We're not able to capture all the local taxes on an annual basis, so we do have a large other category, and we basically tie it back to the census data for that. So we use that as the control for that. A couple more sections that I have. One is on the surplus kicker. And just to remind you, a couple things about the kicker, as it will be an issue for you as we go into the session, and you'll be getting the update on where we think we are on February 19th. is that if the non-corporate part of the general fund, which is not just personal income taxes, which is all non-corporate revenue sources, including things like the estate tax or the insurance premium tax, are all calculated in this personal part of the kicker. If they exceed a threshold, 2% or more above the close of session for the regular session, then you trigger the kicker and the entire amount above the estimate is returned. And that's why, of course, when you get in the situation we're in now, where we're very close, we're within about $29 million of that trigger, the 2% is $291 million. So if, for example, revenue were actually to come in at $290 million over the close of session, and all is said and done, that 290 would go on the ending balance. There would be no credit returned next biennium. If it comes in at 292 million above, then the full 292 would be returned as a kicker in the next kicker credit in the next biennium. So that's why, you know, when you get around that threshold, it really does it makes it difficult for the co-chairs to try to plan the budget. Is the other thing to keep in mind about that is the kicker is really just two numbers. It's the close of session number versus what actually comes in the door. And we don't know what actually comes in the door until early August of 15. So you're not going to know, even when you sign a die, probably, hopefully, when you sign a die, what that is. So that, again, complicates the budgeting process. You can see on the chart there, there's a history of the kicker. We're $261 million above the estimate now. As I said, about $29 million short of the threshold. One final point is that the 2011 legislature reversed an action taken in 1995 and converted the personal kicker back to a credit. Prior to that time, it was a credit from 95 through the 07 kicker. It was returned as a refund and went out in November. The credit now means that the impact on the revenue stream will be a little bit later, and so hopefully that's not going to affect our cash flow as much in the future. One final thing I'll refer to, if you look on B5, if we can skip through there. I do have a little bit of history of the budget for you, going back 10 years, the all funds budget and the general fund budget, so you can see the growth of the different categories.
Just a moment, excuse me. Representative Bentz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Paul, can you go back to the table number 8 and in lines 07, 09, and 09, 11, tell us how you calculate the shortfall? Shortfall measured from what?
The shortfall is compared to the close of session. So what that's saying is, so for example, in 09, your personal non-corporate revenue came in $1,050,000,000 below the estimate. Now, and sometimes, like for example, 11-13, it came in $123.6 million above the estimate, but it was still short of the 2% threshold, so it didn't trigger a kicker.
Thank you.
And of course, on the corporate side, I've got reference there. We are projecting a kicker now, and we're actually continuing to come in over estimates on the corporate side. So that what will happen under ballot measure 85 is that kicker will still be calculated, and we'll calculate what that is. And instead of returning that amount to corporations as a credit in the 15-17 biennium, they will go to the general fund. Right now we're estimating 56.2. We'll go to the general fund and for purposes of K-12. So it says for purposes of K-12, not just education.
Yeah, Representative Bentz.
Forgive me, Mr. Chairman, this is too good an opportunity to miss. I want to go back to what Paul just said, again, looking at table
8.
And going back down to the surplus in 05-07, which was $1,071,000,000, and had that gone into a reserve, then when 08 rolled around, our estimate was off. The thought would have been, what would the thought have been, if we're that far off on our guesses, why wouldn't we have spent all of the reserve and then found ourselves the next year when we were still a billion short, not having the value of the reserve. In other words, my question is, how would we know how much we could spend? If our guessing, I don't want to get, you know, too much pressure on the economists in the room here, but the guessing didn't look like it was all that great in those 2 years. Just being me, but, or maybe realistic.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, forecasting is a humbling profession. Well, a couple things. One is that you've got other reserve sources. You've got the Education Stability Fund. You have the Rainy Day Fund, which the kicker from 0507 for corporations was put in to basically capitalize that Rainy Day Fund. Now it still gets a portion of the ending balance. Ending balance is, of course, usually wiped out when you go into recession. So, you know, if you look at a recession of the magnitude of the Great Recession, as we call it now, that lasted from 07 through the summer of 09, you basically had two biennia where you're over a billion short. So we haven't had anything like that since the 30s. Whether you could actually have set aside enough money to prepare fully for that, I would be dubious that you could do that. And certainly no one anticipated, economists certainly weren't saying that, gee, this is going to be the worst recession since the 30s. So there are unexpected events. The issue around reserve policy, I think, is largely trying to come up with a strategy that will put aside revenue during strong periods of economic growth, so it'll ease that downturn, give you some options. It's certainly never going to eliminate the effects of something like the Great Recession.
Thank you.
Yeah, and if I could just add, wasn't 9/11 the year that we got the big boost from the federal government? The biennium we got the big boost from the federal government to the tune of $1 billion thereabouts.
Mr. Chair, that's exactly right, and where you really see that is in the school operating revenue. There was some of that went directly to schools. It was also a big factor for the corrections budget during that time. So the general funded agencies were helped out by the federal government, and of course the federal government is always in a stronger position than the states to carry out countercyclical policy. We just don't have the options because we can't run deficits.
Representative Whitson.
I was just wondering, for the economists, when you determine growth by quarter, do they use the GDP? You know, when they talk about they want to see 3%, basically, is that GDP that they base that on federally?
Well, the growth rate for GDP is the broadest overall measure of economic activity. Normally, you would see that adjusted for changes in the price level. And if you see those numbers in reference to GDP on a quarterly basis, it's released quarterly by the Department of Commerce, and they will seasonally adjust those numbers, and they will annualize them. So if you see a number like 2.6%, it means that if the economy were to grow at the same pace it did this past quarter for a full year, it would be 2.6% bigger at the end of the year. So that's how to interpret those numbers. Now, in terms of numbers that we use at the state level, unfortunately, we don't have a good quarterly update on gross state product. We have an annual data series that BEA produces, and that comes out with about, they've sped it up, it's about a year and a half lag. So we can't really use that in terms of our forecasting. Mm-hmm. So what we use is another series they have, which is this personal income. I was referring to it with the tax measures. Resident personal income, and that's what the state economist will try to tie back to in his revenue models, is a projection of personal income. Personal income, it's a broad measure, but there's some problems walking from that to taxable income that we can talk about maybe later. But personal income is the measure that the state economist forecast, the broad measure to begin this revenue estimate.
I just want to follow up. So it's my understanding that we just entered the ninth consecutive quarter of non-exceedance of a 3% GDP on a national level, and I was wondering how you tune that into the state then. I understand what you're saying, but are you following the federal, which is an indication of entering a recession after six consecutive quarters?
Right. Yeah, a couple things. One is that we have a model of the state economy, and the model of the state economy is tied to a national forecast, and it's tied to national variables. Nearly every state forecasts their revenue that way. We call them bootstrap models, that they're linked on to a national forecast. We have a forecast service that provides us with the latest national data and also provides us with projections. So our estimates are based on national projections and tied to them. Now, in terms of the business cycle, we've never had a post-war recession in which the U.S. went into recession and Oregon didn't, and vice versa. We've never had Oregon go into recession when the U.S. Didn't. So we follow the business cycle pretty close in terms of the timing, so it's the best single predictor you could have for where Oregon would be. Now, of course, there's a lot of subtleties to that, but it's the best number to have to start from.
So just follow up. Based on that, do you have a projection then for, does it look like we're going to enter a recessive cycle?
Well, the short answer is you will get an update from the state economist on February 19th. We are not projecting a recession in our current December estimates. However, as I always caution people, we're now past the average length of an economic expansion in the post-war period. The recession, even though common citizen probably doesn't recognize this, the recession ended back in July of 2009. So we've been in expansion for a while. So yes, the odds increase, you know, the further you get away from the last cyclical trough.
And I think every economist who's still working will admit that they can't predict when those turns are going to happen. If they were able to predict when the turns would happen, they wouldn't be working, they'd be investing.
Yes.
Thank you. Go ahead, Paul.
I just have one more table, and this is the effective tax changes on B5. And you can see basically what we do. We kind of change this table a little bit depending on what we're working on, but we're just kind of trying to give you a menu of major tax changes. This first page is tax reductions. So we have, for example, what would be the revenue impact of increasing the earned income tax credit, currently 8% of the federal, to 12%. You can see it'd be about $25 million a year. So those, it gives you some ideas of how different things, increasing the standard deduction, for example, or some of the changes in the corporate tax and what kind of impact those may have. On the next page, you can see the potential estimates for tax increases. So as you kind of think about big picture changes in the system, this kind of gives you a starting point for a mix and match, or you can look at, give you an idea of some of the individual changes, like perhaps some of the excise taxes that Mazin will talk about, where you, for example, increase the 911 tax, what would you raise from doing that? We always plug in the sales taxes and consumption taxes. We, of course, base these on other states. This time we have looked at the updated gross receipts estimates based on the Ohio commercial activity tax. So give you an idea kind of what that would generate from a quarter of 1% as a gross receipts tax, basically. So it gives you something to think about, and we would obviously have to work on a lot more detail as you move to the stage of working for a specific bill. But it would give you a starting point.
Yes. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Paul, very much. This actually is one of the most exciting documents that comes out all year from this building, so yes. Thank you for the work. In light of your last comment about the need for more work, there, for example, have been calls, I think, from both sides of the aisle for looking at capital gains and the way that our capital gains rate might discourage, for example, liquidation events from occurring or mergers and acquisitions from occurring in Oregon, and having some businesses or individuals perform those in other states that don't have the same hit. So as we potentially talk about a capital gains reduction from 9 down to, say, even 7, is it possible in the models to sort of predict behavior on those who may choose to keep those events in Oregon as opposed to repatriating them to lower tax jurisdictions as they might do now?
We do have a couple of capital gains rate reductions there. You can see on the under tax reductions. Those are what we call static estimates. We have, of course, over the years had a lot of capital gains proposals, so we've kind of developed some tools to look at it. We do make two adjustments to it. One is what's called a portfolio effect, which is, I think, what you're referring to initially, mm-hmm. where you've got the theory is investments are locked in because of the capital gain, and then this would free up those assets. People would sell them, create the sales event, and then you have a revenue impact. Mm-hmm. We think that's a short-term, relatively small effect. Where we've estimated it from is scaling down on empirical analysis of the federal mm-hmm. effect. And the federal effect's pretty big. I mean, we had some big ones, particularly in the late 80s. But, of course, you're talking about a lot bigger
right.
Change in rates. So, obviously, the federal rate is going to be more significant, although the federal rate now has been low enough, so it's getting close to where our top rate is on capital gains. But we do have an estimate for that. We think it takes about 2 years for that effect to work through. Mm-hmm. Then we also have an effect that comes out of our Oregon tax incidence model. And that is largely dependent. We have two aspects of it. The biggest aspect of it is around migration. It influences migration. We have migration equations in the model, and they are based on coefficients for high income, medium income, and low income. And the high income, of course, is more sensitive to that. And so we do have an effect. And we're back to the process now of updating our OTIM model. Mm-hmm. So we do build that in. But it's a longer-term effect in that case. We think it's spread out over a five-year period. The other thing where we have the bigger dollar-for-dollar effect, and we've seen proposals along these lines recently, is to target investments in Oregon,
mm-hmm.
where you have a broad capital gains tax. You know, you could get a capital gain from anywhere in the world. And if you lowered the tax on that, it wouldn't necessarily reduce the cost of capital in Oregon compared to anywhere else. So it wouldn't have much effect on Oregon investment. What would if you could target the investments that are in Oregon?
Mm.
And that's where we expect you have a bigger effect, but we think that's a relatively small percentage of mm-hmm. capital gains.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Other questions? I agree with Representative Davis. This is a fascinating document. My recommendation is you keep it on the corner of your desk all session. When you find yourself falling asleep and you want to a jolt to wake you up,
energy
that you refer to this document look at the ways in which our revenue situation works in Oregon and what we can do to make it better in whatever way you think better is. Thank you. Anything else on basic facts, or can we move on to potential revenue issues?
Well, we're going to go to our subcomponents of basic facts.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
We won't go through the whole document.
I'm skipping ahead.
So I'm going to ask Christine and Chris to come up.
For joy, we get to stay with this for a while longer.
And have them come up. Christine,
you think I'm being facetious?
No,
I am not.
No.
I'm agreeing with you.
This is one of the best. It really is.
Yes. That's why revenue committee members are special.
For the newcomers, you can see that we actually have a lot of fun in this committee.
What's that?
So, Christine is going to go through the personal income tax section, which starts on C1, and talk about that. She's put that together and updated those numbers for you. And then Chris is we're trying to free up some of his time to do more tax credits, but we've still given him the corporate income tax. He'll go through that with you.
Okay. Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Benz, members of the committee. I'm Christine Broniak with the Legislative Revenue Office. And so I was going to talk in a little bit more detail today about income taxes. As you may be aware, the tax rates in the state range from 5% to 9.9% of taxable income. This is arrived at by taking the federal adjusted gross income, removing Oregon deductions and subtractions, as well as Oregon additions. The amount that's taxed is usually less than the federal AGI. So the effective tax rate is about 5.7% of the federal AGI, despite being about 9% of the Oregon amount. In the 2013 special session, the legislature made changes to the personal income tax system. These changes allowed individuals with non-passive income from partnerships or S corporations to have a different tax rate structure, starting at 7%. You can see that there on page C1, and so it ranges from 7% and goes up to 9.9% for $5 million or more in income. So overall, the tax liability in 2012 was $5.7 billion. This was an increase of 12.2% from 2011, likely also a result of coming out of the recession and income amounts recovering somewhat. For 2015, Oregon's inflation-adjusted standard deductions are $4,295 for joint returns and $2,145 for single returns. The personal exemption credit is $194 also for that year. Notice there's a table on C2. Here you can see, along with liability, personal income tax collections are also up in 2013-14. And on page C2 and C3, there's a history going through to page C5. Of the changes that were made recently. You can see there the 2013 changes. 2014, the changes included federal conformity is updated to December 31st, 2014, and the crop donation credit was reinstated. As I mentioned before, the Oregon taxable income is a product of the federal adjusted gross income, plus Oregon additions, less Oregon subtractions, and then deductions. There's a flow chart that describes this process on table C6, and you can see there how Oregon tax works and the various components that may be changed or not with legislation. And so the next page would be table C7, and this shows how many personal income tax returns there are. Notably, the largest growth rate would be for part year residents, growing 6.1%. But there's all of the types of returns have grown since 2011, going forward to 2012. But you'll note that the part year residents on the next page, C8, are not really a large percent of the tax returns in the state. They only make up 4% of the total, and the largest group would be the four-year residents, of course, and it's 9% non-resident. So page C10 shows the total income and tax amount for 2012. The net tax is totaled at $5.3 billion for the year. Also, this page will show you the distribution of income between the various levels of adjusted gross income. And on C11, there's a similar table, but this shows instead the average income and tax amounts. Average net tax ranges from $16 for people with less than zero income, and it goes up to $107,000 $107,874 for those making $500,000 per year and above in adjusted gross income. And then finally, page C12 outlines the various sources of income. So there's the vast majority of income comes from wages and salaries and tips, and then there's all the other categories there as well. The total adjusted gross income for four-year returns was $92.7 billion for the year 2012. And with that, my presentation is done. Unless there's any questions, I can hand it over to Chris.
Yeah, Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And then Representative, what's it?
The question we've asked over a number of years was the impact at Measure, was it 66? I was confused. Was that the personal one?
66.
Can you show us on this one, or is that just hopeless, showing us the impact that had? Any impact? Can you show it, how much more we've collected as a result of it, or whether people fled the state as a result of it, or can we draw conclusions from these charts when it comes to those issues?
Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Benz. We can't really get that information from here, but we do have a separate handout that we can share with the committee. That'll be the latest update for revenue. It shows the original projections and how much we've gotten by tax year for both Measure 66 and 67.
That'd be great.
It incorporates tax year 2012, but we can get that to the committee. I wouldn't try to glean it from the information provided here.
Thank you.
That would be helpful. Representative Woodson.
When you talk about you adjust for inflation, do you consider, is fuel in your adjusted formula for inflation? Do you include it? Some do, some don't, the price of fuel.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Whitsitt, I believe that the CPI is adjusted. The basket of goods does include fuel.
So do you have any sort of feeling for how this will look now with fuel at a 40 to 50% reduction when you do the new adjust for the index of inflation?
I haven't looked into that issue specifically, but I can look into it. I know that that's a component of CPI and will affect the total. Of course, there's a lot of other components as well, including the cost of health care is known to be rising. So there's some other goods that they will help offset that effect. But I'll see what I can find about that.
Thank you.
Okay, for the record, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Chris Hallenack, Legislative Revenue. And I'm going to talk briefly about the corporate income excise taxes. And again, just kind of keep up with the same process here of walking through the document in a fairly quick manner, just to point out the information and maybe mention a couple of highlights. The corporate income tax, we have a two-rate structure. It's a 6.6% and 7.6% brackets with income below $1 million taxed at 6.6%. and income over $1 million taxed at 7.6%. And this is the tax for C corporations. These are the larger corporations that have different kinds of shareholders and is a dominant form of business structure. And also on this page, we have the corporate minimum tax, which ranges from $150 for C corporations with Oregon sales less than $500,000 up to $100,000 gross minimum tax or minimum gross tax for those with Oregon sales of $100 million or more. One thing to point out, I think most people are aware, but maybe for the new folks to the committee, we do have there is the issue of apportionment, which is for corporations that operate in multiple states, how their income gets apportioned to Oregon. We have a single sales factor, so the only factor that gets considered is Oregon sales. So the percentage of their U.S. sales that are in Oregon is the percentage that is multiplied by their income to derive at the tax base for Oregon. And then there are a few pages of history, or maybe more than a few. and then just a couple of charts here and numbers to keep in mind. Most of the corporations that pay tax here are the C corporations, although S corporations do file their own tax return and they have a $150 minimum tax. Most of the income on the S corporations flows through to the personal income tax. It gets taxed on that side. So just a couple of broad numbers to keep in mind. We have about 30,000 C corporations operating in the state and twice that many S corporations. And this chart shows the long-standing decline in C corporations over time, and that'll be driven by mergers as well as new businesses forming LLCs and other pass-through entities rather than going with the old structure of a C corporation. This chart just gives a broad sense of the sectoral makeup of C corporations and S corporations. A couple things that stand out here, you have professional, scientific, and technical services, a lot of, for example, consulting firms. We have a lot more S-corps than we do C-corps in that sector, and also within the construction field. They're more likely to be an S-corporation than they are a C-corporation. And then you have others like the holding companies are going to be much more likely to be a C-corp than an S-corp. And in terms of tax liability, for tax year 2012, $415 million was the liability for C corporations, and just about $10 million was from the S corporations. And the lion's share of that $10 million is the $150 minimum tax. There are some cases where S corporations will have to pay tax on the rate, and that's due to some built-in gains, would be an example. If there's a conversion, then there's a built-in gain that they have to pay rate on. So some of that does come from the tax rates, but the vast majority of it is simply the $150 minimum tax. And the chart shows the sectoral makeup, and most of the tax, as we move to the single sales factor, the wholesale and retail trade became dominant in terms of where the C corporation tax comes from. But a lot of it also comes from finance and insurance, and then the holding companies is also a significant player there in terms of where the tax is coming from. This chart just shows the breakdown between the number and tax for Oregon-only companies and those that operate in multiple states. And again, just a sense of magnitude, out of the 30,000 C corporations, about a third of them are multi-state corporations that operate in other states, but those about 12,000 corporations are responsible for 350 of the $415 million in tax liability. So it's about a third of the corporations, but about 80-85% of the tax liability. And for Oregon-only companies, we're down to about 16,000 of those, and they generally have a tax liability of $30 to $40 million. Now, the third category here are Oregon multi-state corporations, and we're at about 1,700 for those. These are corporations headquartered in Oregon but operate in multiple states. So the theme here is most of the tax revenue comes from out-of-state multi-state corporations. And this chart provides some breakdown by size of income for the corporations. And again, those three categories, Oregon only, Oregon multi-state, and multi-state. And one thing to glean from here is another way of looking at the concentration. There were 226 other multi-state corporations that had income of more than $5 million, and they made up $222 million of the tax. So it's just another way of looking at the concentration of tax within the C corporation.
Okay.
And then here's a table that separates the corporations that are paying the minimum tax and those that are subject to the rate. And the top table there is broken down by Oregon sales category, and these categories are derived. These categories were chosen is because they are the minimum tax schedule. And so that column is there. And kind of the bottom line here is of the 30,000 C corporations for tax year 2012, 21,000 of them paid the minimum, and collectively they paid about $45 million. And 8,300 corporations were subject to the rates, or they paid the rates. They did not pay the minimum tax. And they paid $370 million of the $415 million in tax. And so, again, the concentration here for companies with Oregon sales of more than $100 million, 154 of those paid the minimum tax of $100,000, but 128 of them paid the rates, and they paid just about half. They accounted for just about half of the tax due to the rate. And then the table below here is that same information by sector. And here's a table and chart.
This table we've just been talking about is one that's worthy of study and review. Simply point that out.
Yes, I
think what you're saying is that we have a lot of small businesses, and because they're small, they don't pay very much of our total taxes. And a few very large businesses, some of which don't make much money and therefore don't pay much in the way of taxes, and the ones that are profitable pay most of the tax.
Yes, Mr. Chair. And this, to that point, using the term business, these are C corporations. The last two tables I'm going to get to have a broader perspective of the notion of a business, incorporating or adding into the mix the different structures, LLCs, partnerships, and But these are just C corporations. And this table focuses on the 8,300 corporations who are paying the bulk of the tax. They're paying the tax due to the rate. And it, again, tells that same story where a small number of corporations are paying the lion's share of the tax. So here, for the tax category, those C corporations that had a tax liability of at least $1 million, there were 60 of them, and collectively their liability was $156 million. So they were 0.7% of the C corporations subject to the rate, and then 42% of the liability. That's one of the reasons the corporate tax is so volatile, is it's so concentrated among a few companies. And so moving on to the last two charts here, this one tries to incorporate all of the businesses. A lot of times people will ask about business taxes, and there's a mix between whether or not they're talking about C corporations or businesses in general. So what we have here in these two tables is to try and get at that notion of a business and where they show up in the tax system. So the first two columns here, we have sole proprietors. These are Schedule C filers. So those are your smaller businesses. And then the farms here, and I've gone back and forth about how best to describe this, because these are farms that are Schedule F filers. So they are the first two columns. I'm not sure why I didn't change this before. The first two columns are sole proprietors, whereas one is non-farm and the other is farm. So the column labeled farm is really farm sole proprietors, is one way to think about it. They're Schedule F filers. These are folks who pay tax on the personal income tax side. And then we have partnerships. And these are different kinds of partnerships, but this is also where most of the LLCs will show up. LLCs are not recognized at the federal level. They don't exist. They're called creatures of the state. They don't really exist at the federal level. So when they go to file, but they are required to file a tax return, they are allowed to choose which of these structures they file as. Now, they can populate any of these fields, any from a sole proprietor to a a C corp or an S corp, but most of them tend to file as partnerships. Unfortunately, it's a little difficult to pull them out separately and distinguish the true partnership, so to speak, from the LLCs in a technical sense. But that's where they are. So we can see the best estimate we have from the tax return data is about 418,000 businesses, if you will. And that they run the gamut of all these different structures. And
Representative Vance.
This is really an interesting little thing here, Chris. So it shows basically that our businesses have remained flat from 06 to 12 in number. Is that what that's telling us? Or is there some businesses that somehow just don't appear here? In other words, we've gone from 414,000 businesses to 418,000 over a period of 8 or 9 years.
That's correct, Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Benz. Yes, the numbers did go up, and through the recession, the number went down, and we are now back at roughly the 05, the 06 level. Now, there's almost always a caveat and a nuance to everything related to taxes. Most of these counts, the sole proprietors, these are tax returns, and some people can have more than one Schedule C. I haven't attempted to single those out, but it really is the unit there is the tax return. So if you have a tax return who maybe the husband and wife each have their own small business, their own Schedule C, right now they're lumped together as one tax return. Mm-hmm. But you're right, Vice Chair Benz, the data do reflect the recession and the slow return. I mean, 2012 was the first year that we grew in terms of number of businesses since the recession. And I think that gets at Paul's comment earlier about, well, the recession technically ended in 2009, although a lot of people would disagree with how it feels in their personal lives.
Oh. Yeah, please.
So how can we tell from whichever chart how many more jobs, because business creates jobs, mm-hmm. this set of charts would suggest that we have even a little less than 07. businesses that we hope are creating jobs. Should we be looking somewhere else other than at this number and concluding that when it comes to risk-taking in the state, we're not doing something right? Or is this how can we take this number and say how are we doing when it comes to promoting risk-taking?
Well, I think to try and get at it, this is only one piece of the puzzle. You definitely want to look at employment. This doesn't control for how many employees per firm. That information isn't readily available in the tax returns, even on this, on the corporation side. We can have their liability. And we encounter this question a lot with the size of a company. There are different metrics you can use for size of a company: sales, gross income, net income, and employment. So this would be one piece of the puzzle. It would be the number of businesses filing tax returns, but we would definitely want to try and link this with employment. And the question of number of employees per firm would enter into that equation. Because it isn't, if there could be some consolidation among firms, so a lower number of firms doesn't necessarily mean things are bad. Kind of the mergers and acquisitions approach. But on the other hand, if you want to look at entrepreneurship and the small business and the starting of those, then you don't want to look at C corporations, and you may not even want to look at S corporations. You probably want to look at LLCs. And then to that extent, even the sole proprietors, the Schedule Cs, those are the easiest. You know, I'm in my shop, I want to start a business, I'm going to file a Schedule C. Now, there are a lot of liability issues associated with your structure in terms of whether you want to file as a Schedule C or you want to file as an LLC. And I think I started rambling there. Sorry.
What was the nature of the question?
The question was about jobs, wasn't it, Representative Bass?
Nice job.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I have a follow-up.
I thought you might.
What I'm trying to learn is, does our state promote new business? And is this the chart that suggests anything? Because a whole bunch of your businesses fail. So the fact that we just stayed even means something good, because a bunch of them had to go out of business, about 30%, maybe more. So yes, somehow we did at least stayed even. That's a good thing. But you would hope you would see this trending up, at least I think. Is this a complete reflection of all of the businesses we have in our state? So maybe we should start there. All the ones that are paying taxes, I
guess. All the ones that are paying taxes. It should be. I would want to, some hesitating, I'm thinking of Secretary of State filings for the number of businesses they have and linking some different information. The question of whether or not we're a state that promotes business creation, it's a complicated and nuanced question, and I don't know that there would be any one chart or one table that contains all of the answers. I'm like, yep, this is it. Right. Even this, I mean, you'd want to break down how many of these are brand new businesses every year and how many of them are 2 years old, 3 years old, and continuation. And to some extent that can be done. It's a fair amount of work. But all of that is layered into this bottom line. And that I'm going to go back to the basic part of the basic facts title for the publication.
So. No. Thank you.
Thank you.
And then the very last chart, the structure will be the same, categories are the same. This is the business income for those same structures. So in 2012, about $14.7 billion in business income, and $6 billion of that was from C corporations, and then $3 billion from S corporations and sole proprietors, and then $1.5 billion from partnerships. So that gives you some sense of where the income is coming from these business structures. That would be another piece of getting at some of that question. Are they just the big companies that are getting bigger, or are we doing better with the smaller businesses?
And again, farms are F?
Schedule F.
I hope there are farms that file some other way, aren't there? Many of them.
C corporations and S corporations, okay. Yes. And I need to come up with a better way to display that.
Well, I'm simply looking at your chart here from 2002 to 2012. It doesn't look like farming is very lucrative.
Well, these are the net numbers. There are Schedule Fs with positive income.
I'm sure.
But in net, you can see what the trend is.
Yeah.
Or what the history is, rather.
Other questions? comments. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Paul?
Okay, Mr. Chair, we have two more economists to go through a couple of areas with you. Kyle Easton will go through the...
Representative Smithmore?
I just thought of it, actually, when
you
said that. I'm not entirely sure.
We'll help you.
Yeah.
You want to run it by us?
No, I was just struck. I was just struck by what you said about the farms, and that in every one of those years, they're all minuses.
Right.
Even though on the charts, their amount of income seems to be positive. So does that just mean that they are all pretty much used as tax write-offs?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Smith Warner. Are you referring to this table that has the income and the income amount is negative?
Yes.
These are net numbers, so I could provide information that shows those that had a gain and those that had a loss. One of the issues, the common issues that comes up with looking at this in terms of the business creation and so forth, you will have a lot of Schedule F filers who are so-called hobby farms. And it isn't necessarily their way that they're making a living. And that's embedded in here. And, of course, on the tax return, there isn't some checkbox, are you a hobby farm or not?
So it's more the way they file rather than the way they make their living, perhaps.
That's a significant question. If you want to focus in on these particular returns, that would be one of the first questions to look at how much income they're actually getting. And if whether it looks like a livable amount of income. And there's also a period of time. There's a farm income averaging aspect to tax returns that would come into play. And so we can get at that information that you'd like. It's just a little more complicated.
Just because the amount and the one on the top one, the amount of income from the farms is the largest section. You see that? Yet in the...
I'm sorry.
So on that C-27... So the first graph, I mean, visually at least, it looks like the farm income exceeds all the other kinds of incomes.
Oh, the farm, I'm sorry, the farm one there, they're on the bottom there, that top dark colored
one. Oh, I'm sorry, that was me reading that wrong then. Yeah, I was like, wow, how can that be that completely different?
The sloppy border on the bottom is actually the negative number for the farm income.
Okay, good, thank you.
Isn't that correct?
Yeah.
Yes, and
yeah. That makes sense.
It isn't
then.
A sloppy border. It's actually the negative income.
That would indeed make... I would be very interested to know in the kind of difference between how many of those are they just file that way versus actually making their...
Well, to fully answer that question, that can be a little more complicated, but we can certainly get more information that might suggest the amount of income given the overall picture for a given tax return.
Great. Thank you.
Sure.
Representative Vance?
Thank you, Chair.
We're not letting you off easily.
Something that would be very interesting, but I don't think any of these graphs draw it out, but they may, is the businesses that are subject to unsubsidized market forces as opposed to those that might control their market. So many times we argue in this group that a corporate tax can be passed on by the corporation. That's generally not true if you're running a farm. There's no way to demand that someone pay more for your product because that's not how it works.
The price takers.
So the question would be here on this column under farms, how can we look at that lack of control of your market where you're just at the whim of whatever the price might be as compared to somebody who might have more market control? That'd be really interesting, but I don't think it's called out here. It's just a remark when it comes to one of the many justifications for why a lot of farming is a hobby as opposed to something that you actually make money at.
Yeah, those are some interesting questions, and there are probably some limitations as to what we could glean from tax returns, but I'm sure we could move that issue down a little bit further by digging a little bit deeper.
And, of course, the definition isn't easy, is it? We have one family where the family enterprise is farming, but either of the two adults need to go out to work somewhere else because the farm is not making any money. You have another example where you have a very successful professional who's got a few acres and has planted something interesting and has no intention of making money on it. That's the hobby farm, but from a tax return point of view, they look very similar.
That's correct, but that's the kind of thing we would start with the tax returns that have farm and look at that kind of makeup of income, Another piece, if the committee's really interested in the farms, would be to separate the S corporations and the C corporations that are farms, if there's a lot of interest in farm policy.
Great. Anything else for Chris? Thank you. Thank you very much. Paul, let's...
Okay. Mr. Chair, next we have Kyle Easton, who has prepared the property tax section. Always a favorite.
Yes.
And
it's one of my favorites this year.
Yes. This committee has spent many hours on property taxes. So Kyle, by the way, has just come from the Department of Revenue Research section, where he was responsible for putting together a lot of the data that we've used and that you've seen and gone through. So he comes with a pretty good background in this area.
So you're saying he's the one to blame?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. Any errors, just talk to Kyle.
Yes, come full circle, I suppose.
Yes. This is a hard act here.
I'll do my best, Mr. Chair. For the record, Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office now. And yeah, I'm going to start with property tax, and then I'll move over to a brief background on a state. And I'm going to do my best of working through a brief background on Measures 5 and Measure 50, because I think it's worth going through really briefly. As Paul mentioned earlier, before the two tax limitation measures, Oregon was more of a high-tax property state, and we're now right in the middle, about 25, 26 in the nation. Measure 5 passed back in 1990, and it was the first of the two limitations, Measure 5 and Measure 50. And what Measure 5 did is it placed limitations based on real market value. So there was a limitation for both education and then non-education districts. And education is K through 12, community college, and ESDs. And then everything that's not one of those three was considered the other, or the general government. And education has a limit of $5 per 1,000 of real market value, and general government has $10 per 1,000 of real market value per property. So if the rates are above either the $5 or the $10 limit, they get compressed down. And I'll go into that in a little more detail, and we have some charts to show you related to compression as well. But that was step one in the property tax limitation. And then in 1997, there was Measure 47, which was voter initiative, which passed, but turned out to be more or less unworkable administratively. So the legislature referred out Measure 50, which had the same intent of 47, but just in a more workable format. And what that did is it did two things, really. It created... it changed the property tax levy system for different districts into rate-based systems. So rather than have a dollar amount that the districts would go out for, they had a rate fixed, a permanent rate fixed, and it was based on what they were levying at that time. So if a district was levying a lower amount at that time, they got a lower fixed rate, and vice versa. The second effect was we have this difference between real market value and maximum assessed value. And the idea behind that was to limit the growth in property taxes. And of course, you can't limit what the real market value of a property is doing, but you would tax based on the maximum assessed value of the property, which is limited to 3% growth. And what that has done is more or less you've seen a pretty steady growth rate in property taxes overall. It's you have a 3% limit at maximum assessed value, and then there can be a little more up and down depending on if there's new local option levies that come on, new bonds, or if a bond comes off, you could see increase of maybe 2.8% or increases of 3.2% if you have a new large bond or a local option levy that comes out. But that's pretty much where our structure is more or less today. If we go to, and I should mention, I'm on page 44 in the PDF. Moving over to 46, but the chart we're looking at here is it's listing the major district types up at the top. So we have counties, cities, special districts, K through 12, ESDs, and community colleges. And you can see the blue bar is the amount of property tax revenue that's coming from the permanent rates. So you can see that for most districts, that's where their revenue is coming from. The reddish orange is local options, and these are the voter approved levies that last for 5 years. Mm-hmm. And they're also subject to the Measure 5 limit rates. And the green bar there is bonds, which are outside of the Measure 5 rate, so they cannot be compressed. And you can see where they get most of their uses in the K through 12 and community colleges. But the chart below, it's showing the fiscal year 12-13 and the 13-14 values. Right now, we're still awaiting the 14-15. It's a little early for those figures, so hopefully they'll be coming out in the next couple months. So these ones, they're a little bit dated, if you will. This is based on the assessed value of 2013, January 1st, 2013. So we are a little behind. We're still seeing the effects of coming out of the Great Recession, the housing bubble ramping back up. But the trend definitely started in the 13-14, so you can begin to see that with overall growth in imposed of about 5.4%. That's the overall figure. I've broken this out by, you have the general governments, your county, cities, and special districts are your main types there, and then you have your education below. And you can see the permanent and then also the local option levies and the bonds and what's going on at a statewide level. And there can be, I should mention, there can be a number of things that can cause these to fluctuate. It's not just the value of the property, but also if there's, in some cases, new levies that come out, maybe like a new law enforcement levy or a new library levy, and then also other new local options can definitely cause these things to fluctuate a bit. So the next chart is on page D5, and it gives a long historical. So this is going back to an assessment date of 1-1-70 up to the 1-1-13. And you can see in the chart down below, I think illustrates it pretty well. You can see the break with Measure 50, where we broke to an assessed value and a real market value. And you can really see that the property property bubble there, where real market value spikes up. But the line below is the assessed value, and this is the value to which the taxes are actually applied, and it's maintaining a pretty, it stays fairly steady, and that's because of that 3% growth limit. And we saw this a couple years ago, in some cases in certain counties more widespread, but where you've seen real market values actually dip below maximum assessed values. And in the 13-14 year, and then the most recent year, the 14-15, we've seen some of this catch back up, if you will, where the real market value has come back, the housing market has rebounded a bit, and you've seen kind of these one-off jumps back up to maximum assessed value. So we're seeing a little bit of that, and you may have heard from constituents as well, where we got some calls certainly from property owners that were wondering how their taxes jumped maybe 5 or 6%. And it was essentially they were a little bit lower in the years prior because their real market value came down. But you can also see about the time of Measure 50, the average tax rate really leveled off at about $15 per thousand. And I'll just skip through the next two charts. It's really kind of the same thing that was discussed in the last one, only broken down by county. But another one, I'm on D8 now, is the growth of imposed taxes over time. And I think this one does a good job, again, of kind of showing the difference in the trend that happened after Measures 5 and Measure 50 and where we are today. So there's average growth rates for, it's very small. It's from 1970 to 2014, and then it also shows the average growth rate in taxes from 1990 to 2014. So it shows kind of those two, if you're looking from the 70s or if you're looking just from when Measure 5 passed. And then the last chart, or the second to last chart, excuse me, that I wanted to talk about was the property tax imposed. So this is an overall imposed for each county and then by the type of district. So we have the major districts, at least the county, cities, schools and ESDs, community college, and then the special districts all lumped together. And there's also urban renewal taxes are there as well. And once again, I would caution a little bit in some of the percent change figures. There can be multiple reasons for what's going on there. So you can see large jumps, but that could be the result of a local option levy. And I'll use Lane County's county district as an example, where they have a 42% growth rate, but that's reflective of a new local option levy that began. So if you looked year over year from this year, you wouldn't see another 42% mm-hmm. growth rate. And then the last chart illustrates the property tax compression. So once again, that goes back to Measure 5, and compression occurs when a property is being taxed at above that $5 or $10 rate limit. And those are separate from one another. So it's sometimes we'll say it's a $15 limit, but it really is, it's 10 and it's 5. So you can be over on the school side and not on the general government side, so you're only having compression to the school side of the districts. But what we've seen, we saw compression pick up a little bit as the effects of the housing bubble kind of burst. But we've seen it, it's moving back down again as an overall nominal dollar terms and also as a percent of the property tax extended. So as real market values are coming back up, there's more room when you're applying the rates against each property.
Okay.
So it's lessening, I guess, the effects of compression. And that's the segment I have on property tax. If there's not any questions, I can move on to estate.
Representative Betts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How long did it take you to get conversant with this? So I'm in all seriousness.
I think it probably took probably one time of going through the property tax statistics. So it takes a little time, but it's Representative Betts. It's one of those things where at first, the more you learn, you don't know.
I would follow up.
Please.
I was interviewed by someone asking what was wrong with the property tax system, and I said no one can understand it. And what I really was saying is no one has the time to try to figure it out except those of us who get paid to do so. Yeah. Is that a correct conclusion for me to draw?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz, I would encourage all individuals to take a look at the property tax, especially when they're making their decisions on how they're going to vote and everything. But yeah, it is definitely, it can be quite difficult, and especially there's some general ideas to it, but it really is property by property. And I know in the interim we had the assessors here, and they were talking about how one of them had to explain to their own mother what was going on with their tax account, and it took them a while to understand what was going on because there's just so much that can complicate things for each individual property.
Thank you, Mr. As a follow-up remark, I'll just say that understates it dramatically. I'm tempted to say something about how his mother might have treated him, or how mine would have treated me if I tried to explain this to her, because it's hopelessly complex and needs attention. That's my conclusion.
Yeah. Representative Smith,
is that famed complexity unique to Oregon? Are there states that it is, like, is it much simpler in Washington, for example?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Smith-Warner, there is definitely complexities in a number of states, I would say. Oregon, I couldn't say Oregon's at the top of the list. I don't know all the 50 states. But there can definitely be ones. As soon as you deviate from real market value, it becomes complicated, I think, in some cases. You definitely add stability and all the things to the tax system. But that's one thing people can understand really easily. They know what their house is worth, and they see their tax bill, and if those things aren't matching up, it can be pretty confusing, for sure.
Thank you.
Yeah. I think, if I may, Representative Benz, the question that he asked really comes from the committee's experience, having gone through this material many times and having realized that there were wrinkles or edges or pieces that we simply did not understand and probably cannot understand about the way this system actually works. I really appreciate the excellent synopsis. You left out all the wrinkles and the edges, but I think as a synopsis it was very good. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I'm happy to go into those wrinkles.
Yes. Well, you will. Don't worry.
Very good.
Can I add something?
Yes. Yes, Paul.
Before Kyle goes into the estate tax there, he does have a section here on the senior property tax deferral program. Of course, that's a favorite of this committee. And we do have several bills in that area, and we thought we'd wait, kind of update you when we go into those, do a little background on where the fund is. I'll go through that with you, and John Phillips will update you on where things are at this point. So we'll kind of defer that to look at those bills.
That'd be great.
For the
new members, you might want to know that we were faced with the probable end of the senior property tax deferral program because we simply didn't have the money in the reserve account to deal with it. And Representative Berger and I worked on it, and we had some help from people in the Senate and from the state treasurer and from the department and of course from LRO, and we were able to salvage the program. but it was a near thing, and I think we're really...
Not to mention our vice chair.
And Representative Baker Peterson came in on the second stage of it to adjust what we did on the first stage. Mm-hmm. But the fact is, this program would have been gone if it hadn't been for some pretty nimble work from people like now-retired Representative Berger in order to keep it. And I think we're pretty proud of the fact that we managed to keep the program. And you may have other thoughts to say about it later. Yeah. Should we go on to estate tax?
Okay, absolutely. So, from the complexity of property tax to the simplicity of estate tax, of course. So estate tax, this is on starting on page 60 of the PDF. It's also F1. But the estate tax in Oregon, it's really, there are multiple ways to tax wealth, which is what an estate or inheritance tax, or at the federal level, we also have gift taxes and generation skipping taxes. But the estate tax went through quite a bit of change recently back in 2011, and part of that was due to some of the complexity that existed. House Bill 2541 pretty much changed us from the current inheritance tax at the time to an estate tax, and it was done after the Oregon Law Commission had a work group, and they presented that to the committee, and much of what was passed in House Bill 2541 was from recommendations and explanations that the work group brought to the committee. And because of that, it has simplified things a bit. I won't go into too much detail, but there's been so much change at the federal level, and the previous inheritance tax was very much connected in a number of ways to the federal estate tax that it was causing issues. So the current estate tax does still use a lot of the definitions and forms of the federal estate tax, but it's tied to the definitions as of, I believe it's January 1, 2010. So it's a fixed in time, so if there's changes at the federal level, they won't necessarily filter through to the Oregon level. You might have to make some adjustments on the forms, but nothing tax administration-wise. But so the estate tax, it's applicable to gross estates of $1 million or more. And the Oregon taxable state, I have a little chart here that explains it, but it's the federal taxable state plus the federal state deduction. So there's a deduction that the feds give based on what your estate tax that you're paying locally or inheritance tax. So you do get a deduction. So you add that back in, and then plus or minus marital property deduction. And the reason for that is when one of the, say one person in an estate passes on, and they are passing, that you have the option of taking a deduction if you're the surviving spouse. And it's essentially a deferral of the tax that would be paid on the estate. So that's why it could be plus or it could be minus, depending on if you're the second spouse. In that case, you do have to pay tax on what was deferred previously. You will pay it on that value of the estate from when the first individual passed on. And then the last part is just there's a few other minor exclusions and deductions that can be netted out. But so I have at the bottom of the page, there is the tax table, and one of the changes that was made by House Bill 2541 was to make it more of a graduated marginal rate. So when your estate value goes over $1 million, from $1 million to $1.5 million, you're taxed at 10%, and then the first dollar over that $1.5 million is taxed at the 10.3%. Mm. And it kind of moves on. You can see how the chart works. It does increase as the estate value goes up. And this estate value is it's the kind of the global or the national, it's the full estate value. It's not just the value of the estate in Oregon. So if you have an estate worth $1.5 million and 500,000 of it is here in Oregon, but a million of it is in other states, you would be subject to the estate tax. It would be apportioned based upon how much your property is here in Oregon. But that's how, in a chart later on, you'll see there are some estates that they have a value less than a million in Oregon, but are subject to the tax. So I have a kind of a series of explanation on how it's calculated. I don't know if we need to go into that detail there, but just to let you know, it is kind of there for the definitions. You can see the actual factors that go in there. The thing that probably worth pointing out is intangible personal property. If you're a Oregon resident, it is included in the value of your estate, so long as it's not taxed by another state. But if you're a non-resident, the intangible value of your estate is not included. And part of that was due to the recommendations from the Oregon Law Commission, where it's hard to know, well, how do I attribute this intangible value? Which state does it belong to? They're a non-resident. we'll just say we're not going to count it for Oregon. And whether the other states that they're, or the state that they are a resident of, tax it or not, it doesn't matter. Oregon just won't include that in the value.
What's an intangible asset?
It would, Mr. Chair, something like stocks or bonds or those type of things. Not the hard value.
Where the company, the underlying value of the company might be scattered all over the world.
Exactly.
That sort of situation is the one they're contemplating, I assume.
Yeah, exactly, Mr. Chair, because it's hard to, what would you bring into Oregon? It's really hard to say, well, that intangible value, where is it actually located? So they just said, let's not worry about it for non-residents.
Okay. I have a question.
Oh, yes, Representative Whitson.
I don't know if I heard. So does the Oregon portion of the estate tax have to exceed $1 million for the entire thing to kick in? I guess I'm not understanding. Say you have 1% of your assets in Oregon, 99% outside of Oregon, then are 99% taxed if it's less than $1 million or greater than $1 million?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Whitsitt, if your value, you look at the gross estate first to determine whether or not they will be taxed. So that's where it's just anything over $1 million as the gross estate, not necessarily what's in Oregon. But then after the tax is calculated, there's an allocation that would occur. So if using your example of 99% value is outside of Oregon, mm-hmm. and 1% is here, it would only allocate 1% of what the tax would be to Oregon.
Okay, could I follow up?
Yes, please.
For example, we have a situation in my district where we have a lot of ranches that are in California and Oregon. They're contiguous ranches, and parts of them are in Oregon and parts are in California, and we've run into situations where people are being taxed for the California part of their ranch but taxed by Oregon. And I was just wondering, does it have to exceed $1 million to, you know, to be that part in California or Oregon to be under Oregon's?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Whitsitt, without knowing the exact details, it would have to be the total value of the estate. So it's not the estate. It can be less than $1 million here in Oregon and be subject to the tax.
That's where I was getting into the 1%. Say you have the house and 20 acres here, and then you have 1,000 acres, just an imaginary line is drawn, you know, and that's California. So then you pay Oregon taxes on estate taxes on that 1,000 acres of that ranch in California?
Representative Whitson, you'd start with the whole value, but then when you allocate it to Oregon, you'd only be, I don't know if it's fair to say, just if there's 1 acre in Oregon, you say, well, what's exactly what this 1 acre is worth? You'd say the total estate value is worth this, and then whatever that 1 acre represents as a percentage would be what comes to Oregon.
If I could make an example, and you tell me if I have this right, your original example was 99% out of state, 1% in state. And let's suppose that your estate tax calculated based on that total value was $100. If I understood the answer correctly, you would owe $1.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Because it would be 1 versus 99.
Okay.
If you didn't have that out-of-state property, you probably wouldn't owe anything.
Right.
Because you'd be below the threshold.
Right, that's what I'm getting at. So, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Other questions on this issue? I have one myself, but we'll go to Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. These numbers reflect the amount of value passing on death of just a minute fraction of Oregonians. Do we have the numbers anywhere of how much is actually moving from one generation to the next and what this device is actually picking up?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Bentz, I was looking at that a little bit. It's hard to triangulate exactly because we do have in-state and out-of-state estates, or I guess non-resident, I should say, or resident. So how to compare precisely, I guess there's no perfect way to do it. As just like a rough estimate, I was looking at deaths in Oregon and then the number of estates that were filed, and that was for deaths over the age 18, assuming they could have an estate. And it was in about the 3% range, I would say. How to exactly net out residents versus non-residents could move that a little bit. But yeah, it is a pretty small percentage that is subject to it.
Can I follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
So all of this work is to tax 3% of the 100% that's moving from one generation to the next, or from somebody else upon death. Is that correct? Is that what you just said?
Representative Benz, that was of the number of, I guess, individuals that die, not on the wealth, because there could be a number of people that pass on that maybe don't have, their wealth could be completely different. So if like one person has $20 million compared to an estate worth $20,000, it wouldn't be a 3% that way of the wealth that's passed on, but just of like a rough number of those who pass on what they...
Thank you.
There are other ways of estimating wealth and the distribution of wealth in society that might get us better information than trying to do it from this material, because this material, of course, only hits people with very high net worth. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and that's another thing where you could even file multiple returns for each spouse. You file it the first time, and then you defer to the variable.
And it might be on the same assets.
Yes.
Because of the way the tax system works. I have a slightly different question, and this is going to be a little off the wall, because lately President Obama has proposed a change in the stepped-up basis for the income tax purposes. Currently, our law is, and we follow the federal rule in this, as I understand it, is that at the death of a person owning property, that person's heirs will receive a basis not based on the basis that the decedent had, but based on the value of the property at the time of the decedent's death. And of course, in the case of appreciated property, like some stocks and bonds, that's a huge tax forgiveness at that point. This is not a question of transfer today, but I'd be curious to know what the effect on our tax receipts could be under various scenarios if the federal government were to adopt that kind of a rule and the state were to adhere to it. And that may be a question. Paul's busy writing it down, so that may be a question for somebody other than you. But it fits, it seems to me, into this category of things because it has to do with decedents. Part of what we do, of course, when we collect an estate tax is, in effect, we've forgiven the capital gains tax through the process of the stepped-up basis. So that's the genesis of my question. And he wrote it down. We'll hear more about it later.
Mr. Chair, I thought of you when the president proposed that. So.
Thank you. I thought of us collectively when the president proposed that, because I'm constantly looking for changes in the denominator at the federal level, because that changes our tax revenues here without us doing anything. Thank you very much. We are going to hold over till tomorrow the major revenue issues review. I know that you wanted to get involved in that conversation, but we are...
We have one more issue on the basic facts. Last but not least, we have Mazin on the lottery and the OLCC, and we can carry that over to tomorrow, too.
Well, theoretically, we're supposed to be done at 2:45.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for the first day, I'd like to adjourn on the time we said we were going to adjourn, even though other days we may be crowding the 3 o'clock meetings. So, Mazin, can we hold that piece over until tomorrow as well?
I'll try to come back tomorrow, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Yeah. We'll hold over that last piece of the overview of basic facts till tomorrow as well. And with that, we'll see you all tomorrow. Committee is adjourned. We'll see you all tomorrow. Committee is adjourned.